I was somebody who, all throughout my academic career, was very affected by good teachers. And in fact, by becoming a psychologist, I took my first psychology undergraduate course as a junior, and it had such a profound effect upon me, and that I stayed in college an extra year to get all the requirements to go on to a PhD program. So there have been certain teachers that I've had that have really inspired me and changed my life.
Welcome to the IPA Podcast, Psychoanalysis on and Off the Couch. This podcast series introduces the many analysts around the world who, in addition to working in their consulting rooms on the couch, they also work outside their offices. They take their psychoanalytic skills and they bring them to many other venues. They bring them to hospitals, to refugee centers, to business leaders, to childcare clinics, to prisons, just to name a sampling of the many conversations we've had. We've also spoken with analysts again around the world about how they and their patients have been struggling with the COVID crisis. And finally, we speak to a group of analysts who meet the criteria, shall we say, of being the elders of our field. They have been practicing analysis for 40 and 50 years and have special perspectives on this particular period of history and an overview on what the field has been like and how it's evolved over the past half century. I hope you find these conversations engaging and thought-provoking. Please feel free to write comments at our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, and thank you for listening. My guest today is Dr. Fred Busch. Our focus today is on a book that Fred conceived of and edited, and the title really describes the book very thoroughly. It's called Dear Candidate, Analysts from Around the World Offer Personal Reflections on Psychoanalytic Training, Education, and the Profession. And that really describes it beautifully. 42 analysts from around the world, representing all different kinds of points of view and different personalities and different environments, were asked to write letters to candidates who were approaching this work and this profession and give them, shall we say, parental advice. And they do it differently. They emphasize different aspects of the work. They are revealing of their own experiences. It's really a lovely summary. And as I mentioned in the conversation, many candidates I've spoken with have said, you know, I read it and it's like someone spoke just to me. This is just my experience and that's just what I needed to hear. We each read, Fred and I, paragraphs to each other that struck us as especially essential. And we have a very nice conversation about it. And I think the listener will get a very good sense of what the work is about. Fred is well known to many listeners of this podcast. He is a training and supervising analyst at the Boston Psychoanalytic Society and Institute. He's very widely published, over 70 articles in the analytic literature and 5 books. And his focus has always been on the method and the theory of treatment. In addition to this book, he's also written a few others published by Routledge, Creating a Psychoanalytic Mind, and The Analyst Reveries, Explorations in Beyond's Enigmatic Concept. And I learned at the end of our conversation that there is volume 2 coming out, and that is Dear Supervisor. So we have a lot to learn. I hope you enjoy the conversation that Fred and I had. It's so nice to have you here.
Thank you, Harvey. And I wanted to say, just briefly, you've done a real service by doing these podcasts, a real service to the whole international community. I think it was very worthwhile.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Well, I'm going to return the compliment now then. Fred, And I guess your comment is true. Mine is certainly true. I have heard from candidates throughout the IPA world talk about your book, and they say something in common with each other. They say, you know, it's as if it was written for me. This is exactly my experience, and the writers really got what I'm going through. And I can only imagine, you being the creator of the idea and the editor of the project, that's exactly what you were hoping would be the case. When you and I had spoken in anticipation of this conversation, you had come up with this marvelous idea about how we can share what was special about the book for us with our listeners. And you had the idea that we would each read one paragraph from three different writers, and that we would share what it is that was special to us about this paragraph. And then we would invite the other, you or I, to comment on what we've selected. And the fun part of it is that neither you nor I know what paragraphs we've chosen. And so we're going to have quite a spontaneous conversation. But before we do that, tell us about this idea of yours. Where did it come from? How did you come up with 42 analysts around the world? What made you select them? Why 42 and not 60 or 20? Fill us in on your creative process.
Well, I told this story before, but one night I was having dinner with my wife, Kadir Spitalaro, also an analyst. And all of a sudden, I blurted out this idea that was the book. What if we invited a whole bunch of analysts from around the world to write personal letters to candidates about being a candidate and advice, etc.? I was very non-specific in asking the participants. I was very non-specific in asking them or telling them what I hoped they would write, except that I wanted it to be personal and personal to a candidate that they would like to give advice to. I didn't want to limit it in any way. And I think the result is that just an awful lot of interesting ideas emerged.
Yeah, are there? Yeah.
From these different people. In terms of why 42 and not 46 or 48 or 75, I got tired. I figured, also I wanted the book not to be, too imposing, and have, 500 pages. I wanted it to be, something that somebody could approach, without trepidation of, oh my God, I have to read all these letters. Also, I will say that I was actually amazed at the enthusiasm with which people responded to my request to ask them to write something. Of all the people I asked, there were only two people that turned me down, both for reasons of being too busy. And I wanted it to be an international book, one that reflected different ideas from different places in the world. And through my associations with the IPA, got to know a lot of people from different places around the world. So I just started writing to the people I knew, and occasionally, if I felt we didn't have enough representation from one area or another, I asked somebody for a recommendation. of a person who might contribute. So that was that part.
Just to comment on the brevity of the book, that's not only what makes it so inviting, but, and I assume you specified this, the letters are relatively brief. Yeah. They're mostly a couple of pages, and I think that was a wise choice because you don't want a lecture. You want the kernel of who they are and what they feel this is the essence of learning to be an analyst, and the brevity really invites that. I also think the international focus is vital because you do get so many different perspectives, and many of the perspectives include finding precious the international focus. Many of the recommendations to candidates have as a theme, don't limit your understanding just to your institute. Go wider than that. And by wider, they mean within whatever country they're in, but also wider than that. I mean, there is, you know, it is an international field and thinking is different in different regions, and be open to it is one of the important themes that I learned from it.
Well, you've just essentially highlighted my first letter that I was talking about.
Well, I'm sure the letter writer said it more eloquently than I just did. No, we'll get to that for sure. But that was intentional on your part to make it as broad as that.
Absolutely. Let's see. Is there anything else you?
Are there themes that, I mean, we just mentioned one about the international focus. Are there other themes that stood out for you either as themes that you particularly heard in it and valued, or themes that you, based on your own inclination, might have thought deserved more attention?
Yeah. Let me read.
Okay.
I want to read the quote from Anna Freud that opens the book. Because there were many people who spoke to this issue in a number of ways. And I thought it was important, especially at this time, because I find this search for what Anna Freud mentions, and a number of the analysts who wrote mentioned something like this, that it's not always so present in candidates, and I guess it wasn't so present in me when I was going through training, but it's incredibly important to me now, and is grown and more important over the years. So let me read this. This
sure.
is a theme that came up in a number of letters, and as I said, one that I value. When Anna Freud was asked by Heinz Kohut to say what she thought was essential to becoming a psychoanalyst, she responded that what she thought essential to becoming a psychoanalyst was to have a great appreciation for truth, that is, personal truth and scientific truth. She felt the appreciation for truth must be held higher than any distress over learning disquieting facts about one's inner world or the world outside oneself. I thought this captured something important, and it's also brought up in a number of letters. I wasn't going to read this, but this is a problem that I had. You know, when we talk about these, we pick three letters.
Yes, right.
From each, and I ended up with about 15 paragraphs.
I understand the problem. Sure.
You know, and
I am going to hold you to three, though.
Yeah.
Just so you know.
Yeah, absolutely. So, but here's one from Roosevelt Cacerola, who's an analyst from Brazil, and a brilliant, he's really a brilliant analyst. He's a Bionian, and one that I really appreciate. Anyway, He wrote this. The other day you told me euphorically that one of the assessors of your clinical report said, "Your text is perfect. I have no questions to ask and nothing to add." You were proud, and I know that you wanted to share your happiness with me. You found it strange that I didn't seem pleased, and because we have a close relationship, you asked me what was the matter. I am initiating this dialogue in writing, but I'm sure we will address this in greater depth when we meet. Your perception was correct. I felt affected and ill at ease, and was unable at that point in time to put my thoughts into words. I shall explain. A perfect work of psychoanalysis, one which doesn't raise any questions or problems, cannot be good work. Flawless analytic sessions and texts do not exist. And I'll stop there. What he's getting at is that I know this was true in my training and how I felt, that, you know, I felt uneasy about my work and how I was doing.
Sure. You know, we all do that, right.
A lot of people mention, and in my particular institute, you know, they weren't very free with compliments. And so I was sort of defensive a lot of the time. But I think what I find, and I find a difference in candidates now, is the difference in terms of the openness to be able to allow oneself to recognize that we don't know everything. We're in the process of learning. Psychoanalysis is an entire process of learning over and over and over again, which makes it exciting and difficult. But I think this attitude is one that I appreciate learned to appreciate in myself and in the people that I teach.
It really puts a premium on learning to tolerate uncertainty, the uncertainty in oneself as one learns to listen to oneself, and you're not sure much of the time what's happening inside oneself in one's analysis. And you assume you're supposed to have an answer, and if you don't, certainly one's idealized analyst has an answer, but that you're involved in a process together of discovery as opposed to a process of getting an answer is obviously an important developmental step to learn. And likewise with patients, with analysts and to learn to help them discover uncertainty by ourselves tolerating it is, and so therefore it's never perfect. I think it was Dale Bosky who, and this is not from the book, this is just from a paper of his, he says, if you go into an analysis and you think you know all of the feelings you're going to have in the process of the analysis, you're not really engaged in the analysis. Something new, fresh, and surprising has to happen. And that's similar to what you're saying. It can't be too clean. And I think that's a fine first paragraph to start us off with, Fred. This is a little bit longer. It says, delving into psychoanalysis, and I'm leaving out names. Delving into psychoanalysis and the unconscious world is a lifelong challenging experience. That does not mean to concentrate obsessively on psychoanalysis. On the contrary, leading an extra analytic life with other interests and activities is indispensable for enjoying psychoanalysis as an enduring journey into the world of the unknown. Life as a candidate can be very hard and exhausting. You have your daily job as a medical doctor or a psychologist. You may be living in a partnership within a family with children. Perhaps you work scientifically in the university. At the same time, you have to be in a time-consuming personal analysis, attend theoretical seminars, and finally conduct your own supervised analyses. Psychoanalysis is an impossible job, as Beyond wrote. This applies even more to psychoanalytic training. Being engulfed by the strenuous life as a candidate sometimes may seem not to leave any space for other thoughts, activities, or initiatives. On the other hand, being immersed in the exploration of your own unconscious, may liberate energies and open up new internal spaces, giving your life new directions and dreams. I think you should try to maintain and develop your interests and activities outside psychoanalysis, although the training may devour so much of your available time and energy. We need friends, partners, family, and a social circle that is not exclusively psychoanalytically oriented. Also, do not neglect your body. It is not very encouraging to observe aging analysts who cultivate their back pain and other syndromes connected with low physical activity. We have a sedentary profession and need some physical compensation. Close quote. What I like about that paragraph, oh, it's many things, and I think of it as the first of three to introduce the subject of training, because this writer starts with our lives, our personal lives, not just our lives as analysts or as to-be analysts, and not just our lives as we live it in our head, but the fullness of us, our physicality. This writer is one of the only people who addresses directly the physical burdens of our work. I mean, the research shows that sitting for long periods of time can be as deleterious to our health as smoking can be. And we need to acknowledge that in some way. We need to help people coming into this be aware that they need to know this and they need to take care of themselves. And from that, I also heard this author talking about our bodies. And if there is one theme that I thought was undermentioned throughout the letters is the physical aspects of this work. The physical, by that I mean that a way to look at what we do is that, COVID aside, there are two bodies in close proximity to each other, and we discover what that means to each of us, and we put words to it, and we don't put actions to it. And that's a very unique circumstance, and including many parts of that, including the erotic parts. And curiously, especially for people learning this work, the tension, the meaning, the conflicts, the fantasies surrounding the physicality of the two parties isn't mentioned as often as I would have liked to have mentioned it. So that's my first paragraph.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with you. In fact, one of the quotes that I was going to use but didn't was similar to what you just brought up. Also, I like what this author said about the, what's the great demands on oneself in being a candidate. Psychologically, physically, and the need to be involved in the world as well as just the practice of learning to become a psychoanalyst. So I thought this was very good also.
That brings up something that others have mentioned in the book, and that is being of the world includes being a citizen of one's country. And some of the writers made clear their political sentiments and their passion about being engaged politically as part of their vision of being a psychoanalyst. And we all know what a current topic that is. Yeah. And it is spoken of in the book.
Mm-hmm. Especially true in the book of Latin American authors.
Yeah. Yes.
Because they're the ones who have been probably more affected by what's going on politically in their countries than many of us up till this point. With regimes that are with coup d'etats and military takeovers.
Yeah.
In Argentina,
Brazil, right?
Yeah. It was interesting. I when I was down in Argentina, I spoke to different societies. I brought up the issue of the disappearance. You remember, in I think it's the 70s, 80s, with the military regime, people just disappeared, and ultimately they were killed. We were at dinner and I asked a number of people about their experience during this time, and you know, what they knew, what they didn't know, what was talked about. And I got the sense that I had just brought up a topic that was still taboo.
Oh, really? Wow.
It was still taboo. And in fact, Argentina, you know, just had 2 or 3 years ago their first museums on this whole issue, on disappearance. But I could see that these analysts, everybody was afraid. Everybody was afraid to talk about it. And they still were afraid to talk about it.
And it's such a challenging question, how one engages that in the office. This was a subject that I took up in the conversation about the climate change, where there is an external reality and there's an internal reality, and one needs to be aware of both. And how one manages that bi-directional awareness in the office is one of the fascinating things that we analysts are facing right now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You ready for your second paragraph?
Yeah.
Okay.
But this touches on something that you mentioned, and let me just read it. It's from Paula Marion. In my opinion, international experience should be part of a formative process and be supported by one's training. I stress this because it seemed to be missing from my training, and when I did it, it was a bit single-handed, without the support and active participation of my teachers. The international dimension stimulates very strong feelings of otherness and foreignness in comparison with the familiar aspect of your training institution. But at the same time, it gives you the sense of a wider community and networks within which we are and which we recognize ourselves. The pedagogical climate expands and compels you to move out of the reassuring sphere of what you know. Remembering what happened for me when I had the experience of an international context, I associate it with the recovery of an adolescent dimension. The candidate leaves home and ventures into a wider space than that offered by her original nuclear family. Going out into the world is very exciting, and yet is this very transition that one has all the more need to feel supported by parental analyst supervisors and teachers. This was very meaningful to me because that was my experience. When I first started attending the American Psycholytic meetings and then the international meetings, I felt there was, and talked with people about training. I was part of the original candidates group started back in the 70s. It was very exciting to learn about, you know, different models of training, and then coming to grips with different approaches. I remember Heinz Gohut was a very controversial figure in my training, although I found his work very interesting and important. And then attending a meeting and hearing him speak was just a very exciting experience. Next to me was one of the training analysts at the Institute, and he was at my Institute. He was mumbling disagreements all along the way.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And But it was a very exciting time for me, and I think I learned a lot. And then it happened again when I started attending the International, being exposed to the French and the Aquinians, Winnicottians, and all of these people, and it just gave me a whole bunch of new ideas about how to understand patients.
Mm-hmm. We probably trained in similar decades, and certainly in my experience, Klein was literally never mentioned. I wasn't sure what this Kleinian thing was, only that it was something you're not supposed to say or learn about. So I appreciate what you're saying. It touches on another theme that's in the book, which is the importance of one's attachments to one's teachers. It includes one's analysts, but it also is to one's supervisors and teachers, where a number of people make the point of valuing the stage of growth where you start inevitably imitatively, because that's how we grow up. We start by imitating. And if all goes well, the imitation fleshes out to identification, where there is both a similarity with and a difference with the people who are important to us. So we have a kernel of their thinking as we understand it inside us. And we also amalgamate it with other inputs, including our own genetic and psychological inputs. And that sort of allowing a home touches on what you said. It's like adolescence when we are in our institute, but then we take a few steps out and we discover other institutes and other ways of thinking. And we realize it's okay. A theme that struck me is just this in the book about how careful people were saying, don't forget to develop your own way of thinking. And it occurred to me that these were people who struggled with developing their own way of thinking and, you know, make an extra point to emphasize it, that they got maybe stuck in too literal an imitation notion. But there is this whole trajectory of learning, the learning process, and how we all learn, and how, like you say, the international context can really flesh out our spreading our wings and looking at things our own way. As long as, and I'm adding this, as long as we realize that the purpose is not to have one's own way of thinking, our purpose is to learn how to listen to patients. There's something that also may be omitted, that what is so challenging to learn is to listen to patients' associations and be comfortable letting those associations indicate to us that the way we had been thinking or what we had been saying isn't correct. It's either not correct timing-wise or substantive-wise, but to listen to the associations to teach us, as opposed to theory teaching us, is a lifelong learning journey.
Mm-hmm.
All right, my second paragraph.
One thing.
Yes, please.
I think what's interesting is that also what I learned at some of these meetings outside my institute was a different way of thinking theoretically about what I was doing in my work with patients. It, as you probably know, I have built a whole idea about what I consider a way of working in treatment.
Yes.
And in my training, there was not a combination of both thinking clinically and trying to understand why we might think this way clinically, which I think is also crucial for candidates to learn about.
That was either one or the other, you're saying? That the focus wasn't on the combination?
I'm sorry?
You're saying that the focus wasn't sufficiently on the combination of what we're thinking and why we're thinking it?
Yeah. It's just, this is why I think this.
I see.
And you know, there might have been good ideas behind what they were saying, but I missed the rationale for it. I'm not somebody who readily takes to somebody telling me how to think.
Mm-hmm. So, well, and you've contributed this to the literature to invite one to have reverie and self-awareness. And that too is in the book, where people emphasize the importance of the self-analytic function, including about how one works.
Yeah. Okay.
All right, I'm ready. Quote, "There is another issue that has to do with what is ideally suitable for a candidate to enable him or her to learn psychoanalysis. The widening scope of psychoanalysis, together with the self-selection of those who elect to come to analysis and are ready to invest in it, have made it difficult to find suitable patients for analysis in terms of what was considered suitable in the past. As a result, I often meet candidates who do what I have come to call, quote, heroic treatment of a very difficult patient. While these therapies are often admirable, it is not always clear what the candidate has learned about psychoanalysis is all about. It is a difficult issue that is also heavily burdened by political overtones, and it is best to take it up with one's supervisor. I can only wish you that at least some of the cases you will see in analysis will be of the more neurotic kind, so you may gain a more balanced view of analysis." Close quote. I think that's an important statement. And I guess one can only say it from having done this work for a while and seen numbers of patients and seen how different people take to what we call the psychoanalytic process, that there really are categories of patients with the risk of categorizing patients, of course, but I'll go there, that there are categories of patients whose egos really function in survival mode. Unbeknownst to them, they're oriented that way, and their attachments are not taken for granted. And so they struggle mightily, and their projective processes are crucial for them to live, and therefore the countertransference is so intense. Mm-hmm. And the basic trust is often fragile, or the use of medications may be necessary for these patients to be analyzable, and the outcomes are not what we might hope for. As contrasted with patients who do have a sense of basic trust and can feel fundamentally safe with the analyst. And so their conflicts are more conflictual. Repression plays more of a central role. And the way of being with the person in the room is of a different experience. And given the limitations of generalizations, because obviously we all have both in us, but at the same time, we all have different ratios of both in us. And I was reminded when I read that of a story I was told by a friend that a recent graduate from a well-known institute contacted him soon after her graduation and said, "Are you available for supervision?" He said, "Sure. What do you have in mind?" She said, "Well, I have a patient and I think he has a neurosis. I'm not sure. I'd like your opinion about it, but I realize that I don't really know how to treat a neurosis, because all my cases have been of a more disturbed sort during training. I don't know how common that is. I admired the person's awareness of what her skills were and weren't. But we should keep an eye on that. I'm not sure quite what that means to keep an eye on it, but we should certainly be aware that there are different skills. The way we intervene is differently. The way we experience the encounter is different."
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I find, when I was growing up as a psychologist, I learned a lot about making diagnoses and how you make diagnoses. And, not that you put somebody in a category forever, but at least mentioning something that you rarely hear anymore about ego strengths.
Mm.
And I think what I have seen in my institute is that there is such a press for candidates to get cases in analysis that the criteria that they're working on with their supervisors is very lax, because everybody just wants candidates that have cases and to move quickly through the institute and graduate so that it's an attractive institute and doesn't look like one of these old fuddy-duddy institutes, you know, where it took time and, you know, took a longer period of time to train. So partly it's publicity, too, that lead to, you know, this very heroic kind of treatments that I think, distort one's view of what analysis is capable of.
And the techniques of engagement are different with different ego levels of development, that you really have to establish basic trust, which is different than interpreting triangular conflicts. Again, I'm speaking with a broad brush, and I'm not suggesting that this isn't ubiquitous in all of us, but cases do lean one side or the other. And I share the writer's and I guess your sense that it's important to learn both sets of skills.
So should I read my third?
Yes, you go for it. Yep.
Okay, the brief one. As a beginning psychoanalyst, it is incumbent to create the requisite inner reflective space that makes use of what has been stimulated inside you in order to understand your patients. This requires cultivating an openness to surprise as well as receptivity to not comprehending. Hopefully you will be supported throughout much of your training to develop and maintain your curiosity, ability to observe without necessarily understanding, and acceptance of human experience. As you learn to believe more skeptically and doubt emphatically, your success as an analytic candidate and future analyst will rest partly on your sense of restraint, narcissistic balance, and integrity.
I have to just jump in and say some of the letters, that being one of them, are so beautifully written that I read them many times. It's just great literature. But sorry, go ahead.
I appreciate it. I understand what you're saying. I felt the same way. I was moved by many of the beautiful way that people express themselves. What struck me about this and what I become interested in terms of candidates and their approach to training is their curiosity. The curiosity about themselves, the curiosity about others, the curiosity about any number of things I empathize with what I see is going on, and that the wish is to be so smart, to be an analyst before they've even done anything or learned anything. I was teaching a clinical seminar, and this one candidate, who's like a second year candidate, kept saying, in my experience, what was his experience? His experience as a resident in a, you know, in a program where we're seeing patients, you know, once a week.
Sure.
So the whole curiosity about a whole new world and one's inner world seems to me absolutely necessary to maintain throughout training. And it's not easy.
And to tolerate the vulnerability of not knowing. One of the other points that many writers made is, you know, the expression, there is no baby without a mother. Well, there is no analyst without an institute. And your paragraph makes reference to the need for a supporting structure, a need in this case, as you mentioned, to help somebody who has a tough time knowing that they don't know, to tolerate that. And to have people who say, you don't have to be so smart all the time. We know you don't know stuff, and that's okay. And you'll learn it. Don't worry about it. We'll hold your hand as long as you need us to. And in the process, you will learn what you need to learn. And some institutes do that very well, and mm-hmm. others, not so much.
There's been a tendency in certain institutes, I think, to be afraid to say anything that could be taken as a criticism by the government. So everybody's supposed to be nice, or some version of being nice, which means this old song, Home on the Range, where never is said a discouraging word. That seems to be the motto in some institutes, and I think it's not good for candidates.
Years ago, I was a psychiatry residency director, and when I came into the position, there were a number of trainees who, by anybody's measure, had no business being in that field. Mm-hmm. I mean, it wasn't a nuanced call. It wasn't a complete. Mm-hmm. Everybody said that this person should be in a line of medicine, and nobody had ever spoken to the person. Similar to what you're saying now, that it was misunderstood as unkind, mm-hmm. And it turned out to be a real act of kindness to make recommendations to people who really would be much better radiologists than they would be therapists, mm-hmm. for them to find their true work. I'm not suggesting anything as extreme as what you're saying, but that there is a kindness to being honest with people, assuming one does it in a kindly and sensitive way.
Mm-hmm.
All right, my last paragraph. It's a little bit long. I love analyzing, supervising, and teaching candidates, accompanying them on their path to becoming psychoanalysts. It's very rewarding to experience candidates develop and grow and become independent, valuable colleagues. I also take great pleasure in writing. All of this is good. It's exactly what I want to do. Still, sometimes it feels a bit strange to be moving along this senior status and seeing more and more younger colleagues taking over. Of course, this is how it should be. And I welcome the growing share of colleagues younger than myself, though next to my delight occasionally, I feel a little surprised. Aging is perhaps the single most puzzling experience in my life. When I see you and your colleagues at our meetings, on panels, or in our institutes, it pleases me and it makes me proud of what my generation has accomplished. Yet simultaneously, it hints at the change of our place in all of this. In part, we represent the past and we are part of the present, and while you are the future of psychoanalysis, we senior colleagues will do all we can to prepare you not only for your own professional life, but also for the task of keeping psychoanalysis alive as a science, as a form of treatment, and a local, national, and international organization. The better you can do this, the more gladly we will accept our share in the institutional functions to decrease. My hope is that you will earnestly and passionately love psychoanalysis, keep it interesting, let it blossom, and transmit it in all depth to the next generations that come after you. Close quote. Now, that's another one of those paragraphs where I've read it many times, not only because I am so taken by the content, but it's so beautifully written. What's special about that for me is, and for me, while it is not the final letter in the book, it could serve as that, because the way I hear that is that this is a senior analyst who is saying, this book and a big part of my life is devoted to being generative towards you, you candidates. It's teaching you what I have learned. It's helping you go through this as honestly as you can and as productively as you can. And I'm here to offer that to you. And I offer it with love, and I hope you receive it like that. That's what the book is about, that's to me. But what this person is also saying, as I hear it, and it's in this poignant sentence, aging is perhaps the single most puzzling experience in my life, something that we all can relate to. but not say as nicely as that. And what I hear the writer saying at that point is to invite the people who are now growing into becoming analysts and then senior analysts to receive what is being offered to them, but also to get to know who these senior analysts are. They are the repository of experience and wisdom, yes. But that sentence also says they are also people. And don't let your idealizations or your various transferences totally distract you from the fact that they are people and they are older people. And we will get out of the way and welcome you. But at the same time, recognize that as we offer you what we can offer you, we are fragile. And that means the part of becoming an analyst oneself to candidates is to take care of one's elders, to realize that this is not a one-way street. This is a two-way street. And as you grow up to be an adult and as you grow up to be an analyst, it is a two-way street with one elders where one has to care for them. And that's why I picture that as sort of the coda of the book, where it's the ending of saying, yes, we have given you all this, but now you can open your eyes and see that we are fragile people and we need caring. And someone suggested to me, perhaps the next book should be not Dear Candidate, but Dear Supervisor.
It's already in the works.
Oh, is that right? I didn't know that. That's great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, beautifully said, Harvey. I think picking up on what this person wrote, what you elaborated on is something I don't think I've ever been elaborated that well, and an important part of the training and of being the life trajectory of being an analyst and growing older and older.
Yes, yes. And it should be honored, both the wisdom we accumulate if we're lucky and also the fragility we accumulate.
Yeah.
And they're present for all of us.
Yeah.
Fred, give us a glimpse into you a bit. You've devoted yourself to many things, one of which is teaching and this book and the passing on to next generations. Where is that in you?
It's a very good question, Harvey. I was somebody who all throughout my academic career was very affected by good teachers. By becoming a psychologist, I took my first psychology undergraduate course as a junior, and it had such a profound effect upon me, and that I stayed in college an extra year to get all the requirements to go on to a PhD program. So, there have been certain teachers that I've had that have really inspired me and changed my life. My psychoanalytic training was a disappointment to me. I felt the teachers were not well prepared. They didn't really understand what they were teaching in an in-depth way, it was very much of the type that, you know, we sat around and teachers, you know, what comes to mind about what you read in this. Mm-hmm. When I wanted to hear what came. What? How did he understand, and what he could teach us about what it was that we were reading? I found it a disappointment. You know, clinical seminars were, you know, like let's just think about, you know, what's going on with this patient, and they lost with the opportunity to put what goes on in supervision, and it's the same kind of thing about understanding kids, into a larger context. And supervision too was, this is what I would, this, you know, this supervisor said, well, this is what I would say, or I suggest you say this. And so I was always interpreting what the last week's supervision.
Sure, yeah.
But it wasn't put in a context that I was hungering for. Mm. Because I'm somebody who just likes to understand.
Yeah, you were hungry for more.
Yeah, something. Not just what to do. That's why I was so involved in training and teaching, that I wanted to convey something different about what can be understood, what can be conveyed in the seminars, whether it's clinical or theoretical. So that's what.
Okay.
I have to say that it's not always welcomed by all candidates. Many would just like to be told what to do. And I try and discourage that, and I really appreciate it when somebody questions me.
Shows they're engaged, sure.
There are certain candidates who people find troublesome, and I find wonderful, because they're questioning, but, you know, they're questioning in a certain way that they want to know something beyond what I said.
Fred, I began by saying how I've heard from so many candidates about how this book spoke to them, and I want to add to that by saying I have heard from many candidates, again, widely dispersed, how they find your writings, your own personal writings, to really speak to them as well. And it may be just what you described, that you're interested in both the particular and the larger context. And the many I have heard from who appreciate and learn from your work, they say, you know, he talks real. He really doesn't get lost in abstraction. He really gets you close to the clinical encounter and then adds more perspective to it. So you are being true to what's important to you, and you are passing it on to others who value it. And I want to thank you. I want to thank you, A, for this conversation today. B, I don't know if we actually read the title of the book. It will be in the show notes, certainly. But the full title of the book is Dear Candidate, Analysts from Around the World Offer Personal Reflections on Psychoanalytic Training, Education, and the Profession. And I just learned that there's a Dear Supervisor book in the works, which perhaps when that comes out, we'll revisit it and have another conversation. Fred, thank you for being here. Thank you for your work in general, your just many contributions to the field and to teaching.
All right. Thank you for the very stimulating conversation. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.